Our collective nightmare. A nursing home on the outskirts of Philadelphia blew apart in the middle of the afternoon. Two people are dead. Others are missing. Staff, bystanders, and first responders hustled the old and frail into the street in slippers and robes. A portion of the building collapsed. Multiple agencies from Pennsylvania and New Jersey are on the scene doing exactly what we expect, poking at the wreckage with clipboards and radios. PICO crews had been called for a gas odor shortly after 2 p.m. While they were on site, an explosion happened. PICO shut off natural gas and electric service to ensure the safety of first responders and local residents. That phrasing is the country's polite way of admitting the safety came after the thing that needed to be prevented. Officials say the blast appears to be gas-related. No cause has been released. The phrase appears to be is the soft cushion we use when the hard facts don't fit the schedule. The place is Bristol Health and Rehab Center, once Silver Lake Nursing Home, about 20 miles northwest of Philadelphia. A high school is now a reunification center. A gymnasium filled with displaced families and paperwork replacing the normal routines of life, that image is becoming standard. A school hosting grief like a substitute teacher. Two dead, missing residents, collapsed walls. Crews from utilities and emergency agencies arrive in neat uniforms and bad coffee. Reporters circle. Officials promise updates. The country will file it under developing, then under learnings, then under review. There will be investigations and statements, and the same cadence will repeat. Condolences, inspections, a promise to do better. As if phrases can stitch concrete back together, this is how we handle people we put in institutions for care. We assemble our procedures, we turn off services after the blast, we create reunification centers in schools, and we print polite sentences about ongoing searches. The ledger will note two dead and entries marked missing. The rest will be administratively tidy and emotionally ragged. We will get more details tomorrow or next week or whenever the next press release arrives. For now, the facts are blunt and ugly. Lives lost, people unaccounted for, a building broken, and the usual machinery of response doing its best after the worst has already happened. That will be the public record. The rest will be the small, stubborn truths people carry home in coats and on chairs at a high school gym.
Anderson Cooper now hosts a live, interactive streaming show where people talk about their grief. You can tune in Thursdays at 9:15 p.m. Eastern and, naturally, leave a comment. This is the 21st century version of holding someone's hand, except the hand is a glass rectangle and the person holding it is a chatroom full of strangers who mostly respond with heart emojis and so sorries. Nothing says intimacy like a scrolling sidebar of supportive GIFs. I love the idea of televised mourning. It feels modern. Back in the day, you'd go to a funeral, cry, get cookies. Now you log in, sign the guest book, and your sorrow is monetizable content between bumper ads. Your grief is no longer a private suffering. It's a programming block. Up next, local weather, then live vulnerability sponsored by a credit card. And of course, it's interactive. People can type while someone is talking about losing a parent, which is both efficient and very 2025. Processing genuine sorrow at the same time as typing same and sending the exact same sticker everyone else sent. There's comfort in numbers, but there's also the creeping realization that if your Wi-Fi dies mid-testimonial, your emotional arc will be interrupted by a system update. We'll be right back after these memories. The show is scheduled, which tells you everything. Grief has a time slot now, 9:15 p.m. Like it's a sitcom about sadness. You can set a calendar invite, attend mourn. Add it to your Google Calendar and get a push notification 5 minutes before you sob. Anderson's doing the moderating, which is great because nothing says processing loss like having a celebrity host whisper empathy between promos. It's reassuring to know the person guiding you through your most raw moments has excellent lighting and a producer in his earpiece. The real first world problem isn't that we've turned grief into a stream, it's that we now have to choose between authenticity and analytics. Did my pain hit its demographic? How many likes did my admission get? Should I edit my story for shareability? In the age of on-demand sorrow, our biggest worry is not the loss itself, but whether the bandwidth can handle the tears, and whether the algorithm will recommend them to someone who'll actually click care.
The Supreme Court told President Trump no when he tried to federalize the National Guard to protect ICE in Chicago. Even the conservative majority couldn't find legal cover in an obscure 1908 statute for turning state troops into federal muscle to back up immigration operations. That sounds like a technicality, until you remember, we're watching the rules of force get rewritten in real time. The court's logic was blunt. The phrase regular forces most likely means the U.S. military, not federal agents like ICE. And that statute only applies where the military itself could lawfully enforce the laws. In plain terms, you can't use the guard as a workaround to put soldiers in the streets for domestic law enforcement, at least not under that law. The justices who disagreed called the ruling dangerously timid or a misreading. The dissents sounded like legal forewarnings. This was a rare loss for the Trump administration on a conservative emergency docket, and it stalled plans to move hundreds of National Guard members into Chicago, Portland, and other cities. Lower courts had already blocked deployments in some places, and officials quietly shrank planned forces while trying to claim, quote, coordination had reduced the need. Reality and PR have become interchangeable. None of this removes the bigger problem. Legal limits are just another arsenal of policy theater. If the White House wants troops in American cities badly enough, the Insurrection Act is still on the table, a blunt instrument that throws long-standing prohibitions about military policing straight into the bin. The court's refusal might delay a move, but it doesn't stop the appetite for escalation. The administration leaned on a 1827 precedent about presidential discretion to call up militias, as if invoking dusty cases will make domestic deployments less alarming. States, civil rights lawyers, and a federal judge in Chicago pushed back, warning that pretending protests are invasions sets a dangerous habit. One state's militia used against another's people is exactly the kind of impossible scenario the founding setup tried to avoid. And yet here we are, watching the playbook get updated. Perhaps the most ominous detail is how cautious even sympathetic justices sounded about future crises. A ruling that binds the hands of a president in one context might force more extreme moves in the next. If the Guard can't be federalized, then regular troops might be sent, or emergency powers expanded, or enforcement norms erased. Each workaround normalizes the next erosion. Call this a legal rebuke if you must. Practically, it's a pause. The machinery of force, precedent hunting, and political theater keeps whirring, and the country keeps testing how much of public life can be securitized before it becomes the new normal. The Supreme Court's no is a headline. The longer story is the steady, boring work of turning exceptions into policy.
This script is based on a CNN article titled, "Sass Announces He Has Stage 4 Pancreatic Cancer, Calls It a Death Sentence." Ben Sass posted what anyone with internet access could read in less than a minute. "Metastasized, stage 4 pancreatic cancer. I'm gonna die," he wrote, and then performed the rarest of political acts, an honesty not meant to win votes, only to state a fact we all keep pretending doesn't apply to us until it does. He called it a death sentence and then reminded us, because Americans love moral footnotes, that we all had one before that. It's the most democratic of truths. Regardless of Senate seats, university titles, or public feuds with a very particular former president, the final curtain doesn't take appointments or insults seriously. You can grandstand on a debate stage. You can earn the label little respected at a rally. You can rate highly on cable TV stress tests. None of that buys you more time. Science is doing its best modern magic trick, immunotherapy, targeted treatments, turning once impossible odds into maybe possibles. Sass mentions that as grace, and we should nod, because hope is a useful currency when diagnoses are not. But the numbers are stubborn. Pancreatic cancer is only about 3% of new cases and yet a top killer, and most folks show up when the cancer has already moved out of the fixable folder. 80% plus present with advanced disease. That statistic reads like bad math, but it's real math that affects real people and real plans for retirement that now look suspiciously like arguments over which day to finally watch that show everyone already binged. There's irony in the public-private split. A senator who once voted against a former president, who got called names at rallies, now writes about gallows humor at home with his siblings and buddies. Politics taught him to swing hard. Illness teaches everyone to laugh where they can, and to stop pretending private pain can be binary coded into public policy. The same country that cheers resilience also monetizes spectacle. The same voters who binge political theater also avoid family talks about wills. We're a civilization that can invent immune therapies, but still can't find a single recommended blood test to catch pancreatic cancer early. Progress, with benefits and plot holes. There's a strange comfort in this equalizing cruelty. It exposes the absurd script we live by. Spend half a life trying to be noticed, then hope the other half is noticed by a doctor in time. The rest is improvised, gallows jokes, whispered truths, the people you actually call when you hear the word metastasis. Zetus promises more words and a fight, which is what humans do, bargain with biology, negotiate with fate, file appeals in the court of hope. That's also where we keep our small human jokes. Because if laughter is refuge, irreverence is a kind of prayer that doesn't require faith. So what do we take from this? Not a sermon, not a step-by-step on how to live, just a reminder that the things we think make us important are mostly temporary stage props. The thing that really levels the playing field doesn't care how loudly you protested at the Capitol, how loudly you rallied, or how loud the applause was. It shows up anyway. There's dignity in choosing the tone you want when the lights go dim, whether that's anger, grace, humor, or plain silent stubbornness. And if you want a modest, slightly selfish piece of advice from someone who likes irony, be prepared. Get the jokes ready. Tell the people that matter. And if science gives you options, accept them with gratitude and a smirk. The universe isn't out to offend us, it's just indifferent. That's bleak and also oddly freeing.
The Capitalist's Fever Dream, a carnival bell, rings every Monday, Wednesday, and Saturday at 10:59 p.m. Eastern Time. And the masses answer with wallets and superstition. No jackpot winner on Monday propelled the grand prize to an estimated $1.7 billion for the next drawing, scheduled for Christmas Eve, a date chosen as if to wrap desire in tinsel. The winning numbers from Monday 3, 18, 36, 41, 54, and a red Powerball 7 Power Play 2, read like a prayer offered to a ledger. 9 tickets matched the 5 white balls and pocketed $1 million apiece, sold across Florida, Georgia, Illinois, New York, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Tennessee, and Wisconsin. Small mercies handed out like consolation prizes, local lotteries, sprinkling hope in zip codes that need it least and most. The run now hits its 47th drawing, a record for the game, a slow, gleeful inflation of fantasy that has become an industry spectacle. This $1.7 billion sits as Powerball's fourth largest prize ever. The largest was $2.04 billion in 2022. Records are capitalism's trophies, displayed while the machine keeps grinding. The choice on the table is a moral lesson sold as financial planning. An annuitized prize of $1.7 billion paid as one immediate shot, followed by 29 annual payments that grow 5% each year, or a lump sum of about $781.3 million before taxes. Both options are arithmetic disguised as salvation. One peddles delayed gratification, the other the illusion of instant transcendence. Either way, taxes arrive like a final practical guide. Odds of winning the jackpot are 1 in 292.2 million. Odds for lesser prizes improve only infinitesimally. Some awards are as low as $4. The game rigs itself with numbers to ensure ritual participation more than redistribution. People buy into a systemic mirage because the alternative, negotiating a life of underpaid labor and fraying safety nets, has been marketed as less appealing than fantasy. This spectacle is its own economic indicator. A 47 drawing streak without a winner is not an anomaly so much as a calendar of collective appetite. That appetite feeds retail partnerships, sponsored ads, and a vast apparatus converting loneliness and insecurity into ticket sales. The jackpot's headline number balloons into a public debt of attention. Everyone watches a possible miracle that, if it happens, will be parceled out in taxes and headlines before the winner's life stabilizes. The game laughs quietly at the word risk, while extracting a steady toll on hope. The last jackpot this year was won on September 6th, split between Missouri and Texas for $1.787 billion, a single sensation that evaporated into two private households and a public sigh. Powerball notes that a jackpot has been won on Christmas Eve only once before, as though scarcity grants ritual meaning. Every statistic here, the sights of the million-dollar tickets, the 47th consecutive drawing, the annuity schedule, is a symptom. They map a society that finances its dreams on the margins of probability and packages precarity as entertainment. The lottery is not charity, It is a ledger that records where faith flows when institutions fail. The billion-dollar number is not prosperity. It is an accounting trick, a marketing achievement, and a civic confession that we would rather gamble with one another's futures than fix the systems that make such gambling necessary.